Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello and welcome back to the Bunker Daily. I'm Justin Quirk. If you used to listen to this podcast on the bus or the train to work, well, you're probably listening now on your daily government walk around the park instead. Remember, listeners, no socialising. COVID-19 is causing the biggest shakeup in transport in over 30 years, with huge bailouts, U-turns and financial crunches piling up as passenger numbers plummet. In London alone, we've seen the fate of TfL kicked into next year and supposedly essential Crossrail 2 shelved indefinitely. Meanwhile, national rail franchising, once sacrosanct, has died a quiet death. How will transport change after the pandemic? And can we afford the investment that we used to take for granted? To talk about this, I'm joined today by Christian Wolmar, the award-winning transport writer and broadcaster. He's written 20 books on the subject, including Our Trans Socialist, Why Britain Has No Transport Policy. Among other things, he describes himself as a driverless car skeptic. Hello, Christian. How are you doing?
Hi there. I'm doing very well, thank you. About working from home.
Aren't we all these days? It is the spirit of the times. So, but let's start with the big one today. As per your book, are trams actually socialist, and why does Britain have no transport policy that we can discern?
No, trams are not socialist. I mean, there are more trams than anywhere else in Switzerland, which can hardly be described as a socialist country. So, I wrote that provocative title precisely to make the point that transport should be a cross-party issue and not one that is associated with the left or the right. Because what is more sensible than ensuring that more people are on public transport, that there is less congestion, it's much more sustainable, rather than everybody in their individual cars, which causes both pollution and congestion. And so that should be really an accepted idea across the political spectrum. So the answer is very strongly no. Trams are not socialist. They're basically a no-brainer.
And to the second part of the question, when we look at sort of the big take a step back, why does Britain seem to have no coherent worked out transport policy? And are we uncommon from, say, our European neighbours in this?
Yes, we are. They mostly have at least a notion of a transport policy, which generally would favour public transport. I mean, look at France, where 25 towns and cities have tram systems, and they're still developing them, and they see that as kind of the future. Whereas we've always been car oriented. And we've always tried to argue that, well, the car is the passport to freedom. We can't constrain its use, but we'll throw in a few buses and trains here and there. We'll spend a bit on this and that. But essentially, transport should be solved by all of us getting in cars. Now, that's not explicit, but just look at the policy. For example, for 10 years, we haven't had any increase in fuel duty, whereas over the last 10 years we've had above inflation rail fare increases. Buses have become prohibitively expensive to the people who use them, which is mainly not very well-off people, and so on. And we've never actually had a transport minister or a transport secretary who's got up and made a coherent case for why we should move towards more sustainable forms of transport, except for one. And that, surprisingly, is John Prescott, who, bless his cotton socks, in the year 2000, did actually set out a vision to have lots more tram schemes, to improve bus networks and so on. and got roundly crushed by what he called were the teeny boppers in number 10, who absolutely were aghast at the idea that we would be threatening the motoring lobby and putting their freedom to drive anywhere at any cost in jeopardy.
You wrote the book we were discussing there in 2016, which obviously now feels like it may as well be two centuries ago. Setting aside the ongoing issue of the lockdown, are we generally at a turning point for transport in Britain because of the pandemic? Has that caused it, or has it just brought forward a reckoning that was in the post, as it were?
Slightly the latter, but mostly the former. I mean, we have been absolutely forced into a complete new world. And you said for the 30 years in your introduction, actually, I think it's unprecedented. I mean, rail usage, you know, actually fell to 5% of what it was last year. And even before this second lockdown, it recovered to around 30%, 35%, but was nowhere near where it was before. Whereas, you know, occasionally I drive my grandson around London. It's about the only time I use a car to his various sporting activities, and the traffic is absolutely horrendous. And so we've ended up in this kind of disastrous position whereby people have been put off using public transport through fear of catching the disease and through government injunctions telling them not to use it. When in fact, actually, in reality, the risk of public of catching COVID on public transport is very low. And they're all charging in their cars, where if you have more than one person in a car, it's like a perfect place to transmit it.
So if we can wind the clock back slightly and go to before the pandemic hit, is it possible to sum up what our transport philosophy was at that point? And was there anything we were getting right, and what were we particularly getting wrong? You mentioned it was very car-centric, but beyond that, were there any sort of key identifiers?
Well, there were, of course. I mean, you know, I have mentioned cycling, and there was lots of encouragement of cycling. There was obviously some investment in railways, trains. You know, the coaches themselves are much better than they were 20, 30 years ago. Comfort, speed, more electric trains, and so on. But what there lacks is any strategy to move towards a better place, because whenever you started getting people saying, well, yes, more people ought to cycle, you then get this fantastic kind of opposition. And, you know, we've seen this indeed in the post-pandemic situation, where there has been this encouragement of low traffic neighborhoods. Now, what are low traffic neighborhoods? They're basically blocking off through routes in residential areas, pushing more people onto the main roads, and creating a much better environment, both in terms of pollution, in terms of safety for walking and cycling in residential areas. Now, it so happens that I live in one that was established 30 years ago. I'm looking out on a very quiet road as a result. But somehow this has caused so much kind of political controversy that now, you know, some local authorities are retreating from creating these zones and so on. And yes, some of them have been slightly poorly designed, but essentially they are about the sort of transport policy that has existed in Holland for about 30, 40 years. Lots of other towns and cities around the world have adopted those policies, because essentially it's got worse recently, because residential streets are used as rat runs by sat-navs and the like of Waze and whatever. And so we need to reverse that trend. And yet it's fraught with controversy. And what I said at the beginning about the fact that transport really ought to be a politically neutral area where we're all together in moving towards the same goals is the only way forward. But I can't see it, unfortunately, happening.
Local transport and commuting, and especially when you get outside of London and the South East, seems to be one of those perennially unsexy topics which nonetheless really matters to voters, and yet governments always seem to underestimate its importance. Why do you think that is? Is it just that politicians get ferried everywhere by car in central London, so don't realise how much it impacts on people's lives in, you know, Rotherham and Nottingham if it's £4 to get a bus somewhere and there's one bus every 20 minutes?
Yes, I mean, trouble is that in 1986, they deregulated the bus industry, and you know, had its faults being regulated, because you know, councillors would kind of ensure that the bus services served their local constituents rather than anybody else, and there was that sort of stuff going on. But essentially, in the intervening 35 years, we've lost really any sense that people ought to have the right to have a bus service wherever they lived. Now, in Switzerland, for example, there's basic rules. So if you have a town of 50,000 people, it has to have a sort of half-hourly bus service to the nearest very big town. Or if you live in a village of a few hundred people, you've still got the right to ensure that you have a bus that takes you to the nearest town at least every hour or so. By setting out those sort of rules and standards, you ensure that you have a basic public transport system that enables people not to have to own cars. And we're not quite as bad as America. I mean, in America, essentially, in many towns and cities, if you don't have a car, you can't get around. Well, we're not quite as bad as that. Certainly, it is the case that you know, in many semi-rural and rural areas, having a car is absolutely essential. Of course, not everybody can afford a car, so therefore, some people are deprived of transport, you know, transport starved. So there's nobody getting up and saying, well, what about trying to help people in rural or semi-rural areas? How about kind of trying to create a service for them? Yes, it might require some subsidy and so on, but so what? And that's at the root of our problem. We've never understood that the idea of providing a bus service or a train service is not a commercial proposition, right? It's about providing a service in the same way that all sorts of other things, whether it's the police or the NHS or the army or whatever, are public services, and transport ought to be seen in that respect. And yet when you put forward an idea for a new bus route or a new rail service or whatever, it's always seen in commercial terms. Will it make enough money to pay its way? That's not the right question. The right question should be, does this provide a very important service for lots of people whose lives are improved by it? And it creates all sorts of what economists call externalities. In other words, benefits for society as a whole.
You mentioned HS2 before and the sort of ongoing saga around that. Given the hammering that the public finances have taken during the COVID recession, do you think the era of those sort of big projects, large-scale investments is over?
Well, HS2 seems to manage to survive whatever kind of declining business case it has. You know, it's seen as a sort of grand projet, as you know, something that politicians kind of, you know, feel proud of, feel they're making a difference. But when you look at the detail of the scheme, it's really not worth the candle, and you know, the costs are going to soar, and the public are not particularly supportive of it. So, look, I think it's horses for courses. I think there are some schemes that are worthwhile. I've written a book about Crossrail, which is the new route in London, and certainly I think that is a valid scheme, even though, of course, in the post-COVID world, it's not going to get as heavily used as it would have done if we hadn't had this pandemic. But nevertheless, it's a fantastic project. It will make people will be astounded at the size of the stations and their architectural merit and so on. And it will, it's a world-class railway, and it is worth doing that some of the time. But by and large, it is the less sexy, smaller schemes that would make the most difference around our transport system, and hundreds and hundreds of those across the country, rather than kind of one big grand projet.
Talking there of Crossrail and focusing sort of back attention on London, you tweeted yesterday that the second leg of that, Crossrail 2, is, quote, effectively dead because of the TfL bailout. Can you just remind listeners what was planned for that second instalment of Crossrail, and what do you think is the impact of us losing it?
Well, that's a long-term scheme, which used to be called the Chelsea-Hackney line, but has then becomes something rather longer, going maybe between somewhere like Tooting in the south up to Tottenham and beyond in the north. So a long southwest and northeast rail line, largely under London, at a cost of estimated at the moment around 30 billion. In many respects, it was a way of regenerating various areas, particularly in northeast London, where are poorly served by transport. And the hope was that it would generate a lot of kind of extra housing in those areas, giving people quick access into the city and so on. I mean, I said it's dead. In response, the people at TfL have said, well, it's not quite dead. It's just mothballed, in the same way that actually Crossrail 1 was mothballed for about 10 years at one point. But you'd have to have a very sort of optimistic crystal ball to think that we're going to get to a situation where a major transport scheme in London like that is going to get built, given the bailout, given the need for investing in the tube. I mean, it still has kind of 30, 40-year-old trains, old signalling systems, and all that's going to have to be invested in, particularly as there's a political climate now, which I think will be exacerbated post-pandemic, that London gets all the goodies and the benefits and the North doesn't. And you know, given the Red Wall kind of issues and stuff, I think we have to recognise that the idea of Crossrail 2 is, you know, if not dead, kicked into very long grass.
Staying with London, your old adversary for the Labour London Mayor nomination, Sadiq Khan, has just agreed a temporary £1.8 billion bailout package for TfL. Is this really the significant win that Khan is claiming? And how do you think he's doing overall as Transport Mayor?
Well, you have to think that the government is bit between a rock and a hard place, because the idea that you can allow TfL to go bust and say, oops, we can't run any of these bus services, we can't run the tube and the trams and so on, is completely fanciful. So in a way, he has them over a barrel. He negotiated quite effectively because they wanted to impose kind of heavy fares rises and maybe a London-wide congestion charge and so on. And because many Tory MPs in London didn't like that idea, that has been killed off. The problem is that we're going to get to a situation where London is permanently, every year or so, having to go on bended knees to the government and say, please, sir, can we have some more money? And that's not a satisfactory situation. And there needs to be a permanent solution to the funding. Remember that uniquely of anywhere, any city in the world like this, by cutting the grants to TfL, TfL was basically supposed to run its trains and buses without any subsidy from central government at all. And that's just not realistic. If you're providing that sort of, 24/7 service to 7-8 million people, whatever it is, you just need financial support to do it. And that's not because of inefficiency or anything. It's just because it's a very expensive thing to do. No city in the world kind of funds it entirely from the fare box. And that's what, oddly enough, we just reached a situation where they were expecting TfL to fund everything from the fare box, and then we got the pandemic, which absolutely made that impossible.
And do you think that political sort of struggle is fundamentally shaping the government's relationship to TfL? Is it seen as a way of clipping the wings of a fairly independent Labour mayoralty and a left-leaning city?
There's no doubt about that. It's a nasty little spiteful battle. And Sadiq has not been fantastic in relation to transport. I mean, I'm a Labour man, but I would be quite critical of the fact that I don't think that he's been adventurous enough. I don't think he's taken on the vested interest of some of the local boroughs sufficiently. He's failed to look at the idea of road pricing across London, which, certainly within a larger area than just the Zone 1 really should be considered. And so on. So I don't think it's been fantastic. But, we are very strongly a Labour city now. He's polling at around 48%, numbers to die for, really. And there's a certain amount of antagonism from the Prime Minister, who, of course, once did his job and vaguely knows his way around it. So this is just symptomatic of what should not be happening. I mean, London's transport system is far too important to be a political football between, you know, a mayor and an ex-mayor.
And just finally, we've got probably 3 to 4 more years of this government. Given that time frame, if you could get one message through to Grant Shapps, the current Secretary of State for Transport, what would it be?
I think that's two, actually. I think I'd one say, look, in terms of the railways, just give up on the idea that the private sector should be involved. Just renationalise them, and more importantly, bring them all together and within an organisation that you might want to call British Rail, but you probably won't. And in terms of the smaller stuff we're talking about, I would say that we should have a serious pro-cycling, pro-walking, pro-public transport policy for our towns and cities. And forget the idea of sort of making it commercial and ensuring that innovations pay for themselves and so on, and actually have a radical policy of making our towns and cities more livable through better public transport systems, cycle lanes and whatever.
Christian Wolmar, thank you so much for joining me today on The Bunker. Hope to see you again soon. Listeners, remember there's a new Bunker Daily every Wednesday, Thursday and Friday. We'd start your week on Mondays and the main panel show on Tuesdays. Don't forget you can back The Bunker on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Just see our Twitter or Facebook or search Patreon Bunker Podcast. See you next time.
The Bunker Daily was presented by Justin Quirk. The producer was Andrew Harrison. The assistant producers were Jacob Archbold and Yelena Sofroniewicz. And audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.